one of my all-time favorite literary works. It's Babbitt by Sinclair Lewis.
One of his more obscure books was a book called It Can't Happen Here, which is about essentially a fascist takeover of the United States.
We just got to talking about the novel Babbitt and Main Street and how Sinclair Lewis was probably ahead of his time a little bit.
I definitely remember Main Street.
The thing that I loved about it is that all the characters in the book just seem so completely real.
Carol, I think her name was.
More about a universal time and place.
But you didn't see them as literary characters, you saw them as real people.
Sinclair Lewis, the first American to win the Nobel Prize in Literature, author of Babbitt, Aerosmith, Elmer Gantry, Dodsworth, and Main Street. 22 novels in all, plus short stories, essays, plays, scraps of verse. Yet for all the stockpiling of wealth, the unbelievable fame, the kudos that derived from his literary output, two marriages, fatherhood, alcoholism, and near-constant travel, Sinclair Lewis remained Harry Lewis. Red, the lonely, bookish boy from Sauk Center, Minnesota. Sauk Center loomed large in his imagination. It informed his Midwest work ethic, his appreciation for rural laborers and the underdog, his social activism. It even played a starring role in his best-known work, Main Street, as Gopher Prairie, the central Minnesota town afflicted by the village virus. Main Street appeared in 1920 and was an immediate, immense success. It sealed Sinclair Lewis's place as one of the most popular writers of the early 20th century. But it also alienated the hometown folks who saw themselves cast in an unflattering light. They eventually came around. Today, Sauk Center lionizes their favorite son. He has his own boulevard and an interpretive center named after him. Now, 60 years after Lewis's death, it's time to look back at this Nobel Prize-winning author, root around in his past a little, his haunts, and take a long, hard look at the novel that put him on the map. How did Main Street speak to Lewis's generation of readers? And what relevance, if any, does Main Street or Lewis himself have for today's espresso-fied, laptop-lugging, Facebooking, multimedia consumers? So sit back and unplug for a while. We're turning back the calendar for On the Run from Main Street, Sinclair Lewis and the novel that changed everything.
This is America, a town of a few thousand in a region of wheat and corn and dairies and little groves. The town is, in our tale, called Gopher Prairie, Minnesota, but its Main Street is the continuation of Main Streets everywhere. The story would be the same in Ohio or Montana, in Kansas or Kentucky or Illinois, and not very differently would it be told up York State or in the Carolina Hills. Sinclair Lewis, Main Street.
Sinclair Lewis was born Harry Sinclair Lewis on February 7th, 1885, to Dr. Edwin J. Lewis and Emma Kermit Lewis of Sauk Center, Minnesota, an agricultural hamlet 100 miles northwest of Minneapolis. Of Emma Lewis, little is known, except that she contracted tuberculosis when Harry was 3, and in June of 1891, when Harry was 6 years old, died.
Little boy, hush, hush.
He never quite recovered from her death. To encounter Sinclair Lewis on his own terms, you have to peel away time and technology. the systems and efficiencies that comprise our modern-day hurry-scurry. When you do, you find yourself on a dusty, unimproved road, muddy in winter, rutted by the passage of horse-drawn wagons, turning off Main Street to the Lewis House at 812 3rd Street in Sauk Center.
Well, we always start our tour here at the front door, and the first thing we do is point out that St. Clair Lewis actually was born in the house across the street. And then when he was 4 years old, his family moved to this house. His father was a doctor, and then there was his mother and his two brothers.
Today, Sinclair Lewis's boyhood home is a tourist destination. Colleen Steffes, president of the Sinclair Lewis Foundation, guides visitors through the rooms.
This is the boys' room. From his first marriage, Dr. Lewis had three boys. Sinclair, or Harry as he was known then, was the youngest. And then there was Fred, who was 9 years older than Harry, and then Claude, who was 6 years older. And on the wall is a picture of Lewis when he was a baby. This is also the original small bed that Lewis slept in when he was a child. I believe they found it in the attic of the carriage house out back. It was still in the carriage house. This is the parlor. Family did not use this room. It was saved for in case anyone dropped in. Everything was kept very nice, and the children played in the other rooms of the house. There is a portrait of his birth mother, Emma, and right next to it is a picture of Lewis when he was a boy. And as you can see from those pictures, he looks very much like his birth mother, with the fair skin, the red hair, the blue eyes. His son, Michael, from his second marriage to Dorothy Thompson, Michael gave us these personal items. It's a cigarette case that Lewis carried, and also a pewter vase that he brought back from Stockholm. It's engraved Stockholm 1930, where he received the Nobel Prize. Then there's the doctor's office. Before Dr. Lewis had an office downtown over Main Street Drug, this is where he practiced. There's a vacuum-tubed radio, which was a gift from Lewis to his father in 1920, the same year that Main Street was published.
Okay.
Come on in.
Did you catch that doorbell? There's a story behind it. There's a story behind this doorbell.
You want to tell us?
Yes.
Dave Simpkins, publisher and editor of the Sauk Center Herald, who has devoted a number of years to the study of Sinclair Lewis.
Well, it always sent chills down Sinclair Lewis's spine every time he heard a doorbell like that, because it reminded him as a boy, he'd be laying in bed sleeping late at night, and there'd be an accident or a fight or a stabbing or something in town, and they would bring the patient to the doctor's house, and he was called on duty to help his dad, almost kind of like an emergency nurse. And they'd use that. Sometimes they'd haul somebody into the dining room, and they'd operate on him or fix him, do whatever they needed to do. Sometimes it might include an amputation, and the dad would amputate the arm and then hand it over to young Harry and say, "Harry, could you take this out into the backyard and bury it?" And he would take it out and bury it. And some of those memories came alive in Main Street. It came alive in Aerosmith, which was about an emergency person and so forth. So that ring is important in Lewis's life.
She romanticized herself not as a great reformer, but as the wife of a country physician. The realities of the doctor's household were colored by her pride. Late at night, a step on the wooden porch heard through her confusion of sleep, the storm door opened. Fumbling over the inner door panels, the buzz of the electric bell. Kennicott muttering, "Gol darn it!" but patiently creeping out of bed, remembering to draw the covers up to keep her warm, feeling for slippers and bathrobe, clumping downstairs. From below, half heard in her drowsiness, a colloquy in the pidgin German of the farmers who have forgotten the old country language without learning the new. "Hello, Barney. Morgen, doctor. Die Frau is ja awful sick." "How long's she been this way?" "I don't know, maybe 2 days." The door closing, Barney's wagon, the wheels silent in the snow. Sinclair Lewis, Main Street.
Dave Simpkins.
Okay, as a boy growing up here, what he started doing was he wrote poems, and he'd send them off to youth magazines, sent some off to Harper's Bazaar. Like 30 articles he tried to sell, and he didn't sell them, but so I'm going to keep at it. And he started writing plots and sending them away, and get rejections. Main Street pops up in his diaries in 1905. As the village virus came up with this concept of this town is really has a virus of some kind. It's, I don't know what the cure is, and they call it the village virus. There are some references that he wrote 30,000 words on that subject and destroyed it, threw it away. So that could have been the start of Main Street. There's speculation with that. I think it was becoming a writer. I think because he wrote Our Mr. Wren, and he wrote about four or five books before Main Street. I think he's just getting his act together. He had it in his mind. He didn't know how to put it together.
There was something down to earth in his attitude toward writing, just as there is in a Minnesota farmer's feeling about the butter he produces or the corn he grows. Ida Compton, Sinclair Lewis at Thorville Farm.
Sinclair Lewis published Main Street in 1920, 2 years after the end of World War I. To Lewis's surprise and to everyone else's, it became a major bestseller, thrusting Lewis into the spotlight and establishing him as a financially independent, full-time author, something to which he had always aspired. Main Street introduces the reader to Carol Milford, an idealistic, motivated young woman who abandons the distractions of St. Paul to marry Dr. William Kennicott and move with him to Gopher Prairie, Minnesota.
That one word, home, it terrified her. Had she really bound herself to live inescapably in this town called Gopher Prairie? And this thick man beside her who dared to define her future, he was a stranger. She turned in her seat and stared at him. Who was he? Why was he sitting with her? He wasn't of her kind. His neck was heavy. His speech was heavy. He was 12 or 13 years older than she, and about him was none of the magic of shared adventures and eagerness. She could not believe that she had ever slept in his arms. That was one of the dreams which you had, but did not officially admit. Sinclair Lewis, Main Street.
Publisher of the Sauk Center Herald, Dave Simpkins.
I mean, if you read the book, and I just read it again for the third time, you know, it's such a great history of the town.
When Carol had walked for 32 minutes, she had completely covered the town.
The different things that make the town unique and interesting, like the restroom, the gypsy camp on the edge of town, the Scandinavian population, the ethnic mix that we have.
East and west, north and south.
All comes alive in there. So you could see, Sauk Center could see itself there. Ironically, so could the rest of the nation.
And she stood at the corner of Main Street and Washington Avenue.
You know, and there's some satire, there's humor in there, but there's also a lot of goodness in it, too.
And despaired. Sinclair Lewis, Main Street.
I mean, he showed town, you know, in his Main Street. I mean, there were hoodlums on Main Street that were kind of leering at Carol when she came by. And, boy, weren't the kind of people that we like to think of ourselves as having a small town. And there was a guy that was somewhat effeminate, might have been, I think they might have even used the word gay, I can't remember, in it. Queer, that was the word that was used in the book.
Yeah, gay meant something different at that time.
Yeah, it was queer that they used. And, boy, in 1920, that was, you know, you didn't talk about those things. And especially, and small towns were going through a transition from being sacred, kind of your hometown. A lot of people were coming back from the war, you know, and they coming back from the war, they had seen a little bit of the world. You know, and they had been in camp towns in the military in the United States and experienced some different things. And they came back with a whole different awareness of what the world was like. That's why the book was so popular. That maybe a realistic look that you know, we love our hometown and we want to come back to our hometowns. But, you know, it's not all perfect. And maybe we need to do some changing, some tweaking, some things we can to make it better.
Main Street is a microcosm. It presents us with a small town.
Charles Baxter is a National Book Award finalist for his novel, The Feast of Love. He's also a creative writing professor at the University of Minnesota.
It creates its plot by virtue of a character, Carol Kennicott, who is not at home in a place where everybody else feels at home.
Lewis's contemporary was F. Scott Fitzgerald, another Minnesota author who felt compelled to distance himself from his birthplace in order to write. Though Lewis made trips to Minnesota, even living there for extended periods, he never set down roots.
Fitzgerald and Sinclair Lewis are really polar opposites. Well, Fitzgerald had much more of a feeling, I think, for the lyric moment in writing. He was obsessed by and interested in glamour and beauty and the way that historical forces in the United States create these moments when somebody out of a great hope or imaginative sense of self tries to become bigger than he is. And in Fitzgerald, we remember these moments, and we often remember the beautiful sentences. And that sort of sense of visionary scope that you perceive at the end, let's say, of The Great Gatsby. There are no such moments in Sinclair Lewis. His plots aren't particularly brilliant. The sentences are the sentences are plain for the most part. Very rarely do they take on any kind of lyrical flow. There isn't much of a sense of a larger vision in his novels either. But what he's got, and what he knows he has, is a great gift for characterizations.
Harry and Juanita Haydock, Rita Simons, and Dr. Terry Gould, the young, smart set of Gopher Prairie. She was led to them. Juanita Haydock flung at her in a high, cackling, friendly voice. "Well, this is just so nice to have you here. We'll have some good parties, dances and everything. You'll have to join the Jolly 17. We play bridge and have supper once a month. You play, of course."
"No, I don't."
"Really? In St. Paul?"
"I've always been such a bookworm."
"We'll have to teach you. Bridge is half the fun of life." Juanita had become patronizing, and she glanced disrespectfully at Carol's golden sash, which she had previously admired. Harry Haydock said politely,
"How do you think you're going to like the old burg?"
"I'm sure I'll like it tremendously."
"Best people on earth here. Great hustlers, too. Of course, I've had lots of chances to live in Minneapolis, but we like it here. Real he-town."
Sinclair Lewis, Main Street.
At Home and Away, the man behind the books.
Lewis was a man of marked opposites. He held in contempt anyone who could not take criticism. Yet, he became incensed at the slightest suggestion of criticism himself. He laughed sympathetically at the set, rutted life of provincial Americans, holding that New Yorkers were the most provincial of all. Yet wherever he went in America, England, or Europe, he took with him his unbroken daily habits of living. Coffee, prepared the night before and left in a thermos, to drink at 5 or 6 in the morning when he awoke, American cigarettes in an endless chain, his own typewriter, and writing materials. It wasn't until later reflection that I realized that physically, the man could be called ugly. His face was like a mask, badly pitted from frequent skin operations. His head was small for his over 6-foot gangling frame. His extremely long skeletal hands protruded from his jacket sleeves and seemed to operate independently from his body. But he used them effectively, and they were fascinating to watch. Ida Compton, Sinclair Lewis at Thorvell Farm.
Sinclair Lewis was a writer of some renown. Though he was born over 125 years ago, his life is attested to in landmarks, festivals, his novels, biographies, memoirs of people who knew him, like Ida Compton, a young woman who befriended him in the late 1940s, and the yarns passed down the generations by people who actually knew Lewis the man. A man or a woman and the creative artist are two separate entities, even if contained in the same body. The artist, at his best, is an aspiration toward which a man may reach, but never claim. A man, at his best, is a confusing patchwork of dreams, successes, faults, generosities, and insecurities. The man, Sinclair Lewis, married Grace Hager in 1914. Grace, or Gracie as she was known, was at his side in the lean years and through the immense success of Main Street, which, with the books that followed, Babbitt, 1922, Aerosmith, 1925, Mantrap, 1926, Elmer Gantry, 1927, and Dodsworth, in 1929, would have made him a millionaire in today's dollars, according to Dave Simpkins. He was the toast of the town, the voice of a generation shocked by the barbed wire and body count of World War I. He was an alcoholic. His marriage to Gracie fell apart, so too his second marriage to Dorothy Thompson, one of the most famous columnists of the 30s and 40s, next to Eleanor Roosevelt.
Oh, here, wait. Let me get one, because most of these are types. Let me get one that he hand-wrote.
Tom Stamen is the archivist at St. Cloud State University, where a number of Lewis documents are collected.
I mean, these are easy writing, reading when they're typewritten, which is nice.
He reads a letter Lewis wrote to Marcella Powers.
Darling, what a week. Motoring from Olivet, Michigan to Madison, Wisconsin, nearly 400 miles. Oh, this is great stuff. After reading all these, you're like, maybe I had never read these, and we thought maybe they were, PG-13 or rated R, and nothing. But what you got from all this was that he was flipped out over this woman. But you can see that relationship change over time, because she ended up marrying somebody else, and towards the end it was sort of like the fatherly figure, giving that advice, but he still was in love with Marcella Powers.
In later years, Lewis had a number of relationships, intimate but more often platonic, with younger women. Tom Stamen.
Marcella Powers passed away in 1985. These letters are given to a friend who sold them to St. Cloud State University. So Lewis, in 1939, Lewis was acting in a play called Ah, Wilderness in Provincetown, Rhode Island. And Marcella Powers was an 18-year-old who was trying to get into theater, and she would cue him on lines, I guess, from what I understand. And Lewis was smitten with her, and he was 54 years old, and they struck up this relationship for many years. And really, those letters are, they're love letters. They're essentially love letters. those early letters, well, like the first 3 or 4 years, he's completely flipped out over this woman.
By that time, he had won the Nobel Prize. When he acquired this house, he had won the Nobel Prize. I think at least 4 or 5 of his novels had been turned into movies.
Charles Baxter's parents knew a recently divorced Sinclair Lewis when he lived in Minneapolis's Kenwood neighborhood in the 1940s.
He was a regular on network radio shows. He was a public figure. And financially, he was very well off, although my mother always complained that he was cheap. You could only get one drink there before dinner and then one serving of chicken. And that was it. He had a falling out with everybody. He insisted on betrayal. And what happened between him and my mother was that my father was going to go to a class reunion at Williams. My mother was going to come along, and she was going to visit Lewis at Thorvale Farm in Massachusetts. And her mother, who was still alive, wouldn't hear of it, thought that it was scandalous that a married woman would visit a single man unchaperoned at his house. And my mother decided that she would not visit him, and that caused the breach between them. And it was done.
Sinclair Lewis died in Rome in 1951. He was flown back to Sauk Center.
When the bell rang long and persistently, early one January morning, I wondered who might be phoning me from more than 5 miles away. "Hello, this is Claude." A chipper male voice came through clearly. "Hal's ashes arrived yesterday." Hal's ashes were the remains of Sinclair Lewis, the first American to win the Nobel Prize in Literature. Here, in the final show, he had top billing. Instead of the reporters who were somewhere in the back of the auditorium, I felt there should have been drama critics. Fifth row center. The highest tribute of all was the omission of applause. Ida Compton, Sinclair Lewis at Thorvale Farm.
Sometimes he feels like an old uncle, a member of the family that I've known for 22 years.
Main Street.
What percentage of the people in the nation read and follow Sinclair Lewis today?
Struck a chord with thousands and thousands of readers.
He's part of the history.
He's part of our culture.
It was gigantic. It was a huge phenomenon.
I think his importance to Sauk Center is very similar proportionally to the nation.
It was as if the oppression of the American small town had never been spoken of before. Until Main Street came up.
It's probably 2-3% of the literary public, if you say.
And it still has its effects around the world.
People recognize that, and I believe they're all very proud of that.
Mm-hmm. Music composed and performed by Ross Johnson, voice acting by Alice Berry and Peggy Mandel. This is Britt Ahmet for KFAI.
Mini Culture on KFAI is made possible by listeners like you and the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.